right, welcome to episode 2. This episode is called I Have Nothing to Hide.
Really? And you have nothing to hide?
It's not about me.
Okay.
And it's really a deep dive, or maybe shallow, depends on how you look at it, into data privacy, right? Because this is something really important. It concerns all of us. And I want to start out by saying, you know, if we're really being honest, how often do any of us read the terms and conditions before signing up to a service online, right? That's where we got our name.
Mm-hmm.
In case you were wondering. Great name, right?
Yes. I came up with it. Just so you know.
So the thing is, what are we giving up to access these free services? At Policy, a civic technology organization here in Kampala that I run, we recently launched a project called Our Internet, My Rights. And we did this together with CIPESA to look at how data privacy and protection affect citizen participation. And it was a media project trying to use art to get people to think more seriously about data privacy, because we're not taking it seriously. We put the question out there, do we know what happens to our personal data every time we click I have agreed to the terms and conditions? And then, you know, what happens to our data when we sign up for something more serious, like a national ID? Or when we vote, when we complain about public services, are we allowed to complain about public services? Does our data end up as a wrapper for samosas and kebabs, or is it well protected? Because really, privacy is a human right. It's recognized by the UN Declaration of Human Rights. The right to privacy, getting a bit technical, refers to the concept that our personal information is protected from public scrutiny. It's just our right. We have the right to be left alone. And privacy is a core aspect of our dignity, and it's as important as freedom of association or freedom of speech. And we really need to understand that, very fundamentally, digital rights are human rights.
Yeah, so I would ask our audience what privacy means in their local language. Because in Amharic, there's no exact translation of privacy in Amharic or in very different languages as well. And even the concept of privacy, I mean, we're like talking about specifically in our context, which is in the African continent, right? So we don't have the concept of privacy when you live in a very communal setting is not a priority, right? Like, so your neighbors, my neighbor knows how many kids live in that house, which one has a boyfriend, which one doesn't have a boyfriend, which one comes late.
All the goss.
You know, all the goss, right? So we live in that context. But then now that's... it becomes a bit different when a big company knows all of the stuff about you and you have no idea what you've shared. Right. So we're specifically talking about data protection and privacy on the African continent. So just like to give you a few figures out there, out of the 54 countries in the continent, it's only 22 countries that have enacted a data protection and privacy law. Countries like Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanzania, Malawi, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, and of course Nigeria, until like August 2018, according to Article 19, for instance, are still in the drafting stage of data protection law. So it's super interesting. And of course, Ethiopia is like always 20 years behind. So the recent draft that I was able to see was a draft from 1989. It was drafted in 1989 by the British, and they just copied from the Brits in 1998. And can you just imagine, what are the different ways that, you know, we're processing data and we've changed, and now we're still working on a data protection law that was drafted in 1988. So that's quite problematic in a lot of ways that you can see it. So the challenge with data protection and privacy laws in Africa are multidimensional. So it starts with getting a government to put the data protection and privacy issues on the agenda, which has taken us so many years. It's still a challenge. Some countries don't even care about that and don't even see it as a problem. Yeah. So the first challenge is really pushing and arguing and like screaming understanding that this is an issue.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, I mean, Cambridge Analytica and like the Kenyan context has made it an issue. Like, you know, you've in a lot of meetings that I am in, and I'm sure you're in as well, Nima, that you see the Cambridge Analytica and election points being raised.
It was a good wake up call at the very least.
Also, they, all that, right? All so, that. Yeah. So, and once you get them to care about this issue, it becomes, it's about making sure you get a specific government body to take this issue. For instance, in the Ethiopian context again, we've had two competing interests from one, INSA. INSA is the Information National Security Agency, which is the NSA version of Ethiopia. So can you imagine giving that organization on its own coming up with the data protection law? In what context will they come up with it? They're an intelligence group that wants to amass as much data as possible, right? And then we have the former Ministry of Communication and IT, which and like I guess in the Ethiopian context and in my context specifically, both were not and are still not fit to put data protection and privacy in a human rights lens. And then you just imagine that you've passed all of the stage, and once the issue is taken up by government, by a specific government ministry, the next challenge is getting a data protection law or a draft that adequately addresses the issues. By the time these laws normally get to parliament for consideration, they've been watered down to appease mainly private sector interests.
Right.
And once these laws are enacted, you know, you've passed that whole stage of like, you know, arguing, fighting, and like you have a specific law. The challenge is getting a strong data regulator that will take violators to task when they fail to protect personal data. And the implementation part is so difficult. Yeah. And I think one maybe good data regulator that we can call out in this region, well, in this continent, is the Ghanaian one.
Mm.
They've done a lot of work. You know, the woman is like fierce.
Kudos.
Like kudos to Ghanaians. They do so many things right, including jollof. Huh?
Ooh.
Yeah. well, we'll see. Yeah. Anyway, so data privacy focuses on the use and governance of personal data. This includes the collection, usage, and sharing of your personal data by companies or even governments.
Yeah, well said. So one of the arguments you often hear when talking about data privacy is, I have nothing to hide. I'm an open book. You would only be concerned about your privacy if you're involved in illegal activities. And of course, this is a myth. When you think about it, many governments already spy on us. They already spy on citizens to prevent political opposition. I'm not a political person. I don't want to get into politics. But I do often find that I self-censor myself for fear of upsetting the wrong people, whoever they might be. Like the number of times I write a tweet and then immediately delete it. Like I'm sure Twitter has this archive of all my Facebook actually does that.
Yeah.
Like anything you type in a little box gets saved, right?
Yeah. And they analyze that, by the way.
Oh, no.
Yes.
So the thing is, if we're already self-censoring ourselves, can you really have a true democracy? Can you really freely express yourself? Thought about that? Or what about stopping cyberbullying from, you know, cyberbullies from accessing your information, and then they can harm your reputation, or they can actually, you know, harm yourself. They can see where you live. If you actually just look up on Twitter, people who say they're going on vacation. So thieves just go through your time, like they just type in going on vacation, going on holiday. And then they see everyone who's out of town, and then they break into your house and rob you. You had nothing to hide. You're going on vacation. There's so many issues to consider. There's so many issues on privacy that, you know, that's bigger than us. It's not just how ethical or how moral we are. I always see this on Twitter where people will attack victims and say, oh, I'm not that kind of person. I'm glad that I have morality. But it can happen to any of us. And then who is going to protect us in those moments because we didn't protect the other people?
Yeah, so for instance, one of the common privacy and data violations that we've come across in this region, especially in the East African context, in the Ugandan context, is unsolicited message from advertisers and service providers. So the famous one here in Uganda is MTN Uganda was sued a while back by an individual for receiving these messages from MTN. We're still waiting to see what's going to happen to that case. And there are different ways that you can think about it. So you can also go to this website called haveibeenpwned.com. It's haveibeenpwned.com to check out if any of the platforms you've been using have ever, like if they've been ever compromised. So for instance, when I put in my email, I can see that some of my accounts associated with this specific email have been compromised. So for instance, the really famous one is LinkedIn back, I think 2014, 2012 was... it was hacked. Dropbox. These are the ones that I can see, for instance. So this means that someone that had access to my username and password for this platform could potentially also see my credit card and like, you know, where I lived and all of those things, right? And of course, please go check that if you've been compromised in any way. Make sure, of course, you change your passwords. Don't use the same passwords for all of your platforms. You know, those are the basic things that we can tell you today.
Yeah. Tactical Tech has a great website called Me and My Shadow, and I think the website is myshadow.org.
Yep.
Yep. And it's really cool. It's a great website talking about data detoxification. And it dispels some of the common myths around data privacy. Of course, the first one being, I have nothing to hide. And here are some of them. And let me know if you've ever said some of these comments. I don't care that people know that I eat cornflakes for breakfast. Right? So you're like, I post photos of my food. I don't care. Who knows, but maybe you're posting from, you know, out of town. And that's a good opportunity for someone to come in and look at your house. The second one is it's just the internet, right? A lot of people have this mindset, oh, it's just the internet. It's just this online space. It's not reality. But so much of our lived lives are now online. So it's not just the internet. Here's another one. But I'm just one in millions. How can anyone see me? Or, but I'm getting the service for free, so I should give you my information. Mm-hmm. Or this is a big one, right? I'm not from the West. This is not an issue for me. So
well,
a lot of people across our continent say that they're not going to be influenced or attacked because these are things for outside people.
I'm hoping this conversation and like issues that we're raising will help you sort of map where you are in terms of your data and privacy and who you've shared your information with. But with that today, we want to bring in our guests. First, we'll be talking to an information security expert called Bernard Wanyama and CEO of Data Science LTD in Kenya, Lynette Kwamboka. We've been actively following Lynette's work as a fellow at Mozilla working on their core principles and that individual security and privacy are fundamental to online experience.
Bernard Wanyama is an information security expert with a focus on cyber. Bernard, please just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you see is the current landscape of data privacy in our context.
Thank you, Nima. My name is Bernard, as she said, Wanyama. I'm an information security practitioner. I work with the Syntec Associates, and I'm also a member of ISACA Kampala chapter. So, with respect to privacy and internet and the whole GDPR, we're seeing a lot more consciousness on the part of end users and developers and companies that deal with information that's collected from end users over the internet and maybe over other channels. We're also seeing governments backing legislation and regulations that are geared towards improving the state of privacy controls and other risk management activities around making sure that people's privacy is protected. But generally, the traction is not as much as one would have hoped, given the urgency of the issue. Many people still react. They're not proactive when it comes to information security. It's an incident that goes viral on the media that now shocks people into wondering where exactly they've been and what exactly companies like the social media giants have been doing with their information all along. So we need to have more awareness, and the laws also need to be more practical, because it's one thing to have the law in place. It's quite another thing for that law to have an impact in the real sense. What we've seen is laws are put in place, but perhaps to tick a box and say, we have privacy, we have data privacy legislation active in this country. It's been passed, and somebody will perhaps get an applause for that. But the implementation and that law having a purpose in the lives and protecting businesses and protecting privacy of individuals, that's yet to happen, and that's where we need to do a lot of work.
So in contexts where there are no data protection laws, what works?
In the instances where there's no laws, we've seen law enforcement agencies, especially the police, making use of the antiquated legislation like the Penal Code Act. They would typically charge somebody with disturbing somebody else's peace or being a nuisance or slander, but there is no specific legislation that you can use to prosecute somebody successfully with respect to privacy, because you get to a point where perhaps the definition of the crime scene and the ingredients of the crime do not really match what the 1950s law mandates compared to what somebody is doing perhaps over electronic channels today, in terms of invading somebody's privacy or violating that.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because the challenge that we have now and the laws as they are, the laws that have been passed in the 1989, the 90s, that doesn't really cover the problem that we're facing today. And there was a very specific case in Ethiopia where this woman goes to like a Photoshop, like and then she takes a picture, and then the like photographer decides to post her picture outside on the window so that other people can come also take pictures. And she like there was a really big case where she asked him to take it down. He said no. He was sued, and it had to go all the way to the Supreme Court. And lastly, they decided in favor of, like, you know, protecting her privacy, and he was forced to take it down. And that's the only privacy related case that, you know, has been able to set some precedents. But for a lot of the problems that you have, you know, either your pictures being taken and posted on social media or, like, you know, on somebody's website, there's nothing that you can do or, like, really go to challenge those places. And it's quite a big challenge. But really, delving more onto this, have there been any, like, we know there are data leaks that happen, like, within Facebook, Twitter, and other places, right? And I'm sure there must be some cases with, like, you know, either the telecom providers in this continent or, you know, the service providers that have, you know, amassed a lot of personal data of individuals. Do we hear any of those? Do they report it? Do we have any interesting cases?
The cases that we've seen have largely been one-on-one, where people's bank details or people's mm-hmm. transaction records have been leaked.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, it's related to an ongoing scandal, or there's a celebrity involved, or somebody of public interest is involved. And much of that, when it happens, we don't see direct prosecution. You mm-hmm. see law enforcement coming in and arresting the person and holding them for a few days, slapping a certain range of charges on them.
Mm-hmm.
But those don't hold much water.
Mm-hmm.
And so the prosecution process ends prematurely. And so you do not have a serious precedent that you can cite and say this is a deterrent example that will go down in the memory of people to know that this is what happens when you invade somebody's privacy.
Mm.
We do not really have a solid case that we can cite and say this is a successful prosecution, which you can cite and look back and say this was effective.
So you're an information security expert. So let's talk about the infrastructure and, like, you know, the back end of where our data is stored. What do you think companies should do to make sure that their data, they protect, you know, people's data more? But then in terms of the, you know, the flaws that we see within the infra, the, you know, the back end and the infrastructure within companies, what can you tell us a bit more about that?
It comes down to what are the values that we espouse as society in Uganda? Do we feel that it's important to protect the privacy of an individual?
Mm.
How much value do we attach to one human being's rights to privacy? And, you know, that determines the rest of the conversation, because laws must be enacted to channel society's appreciation or value for certain principles. If laws do not match what society feels, then you have a law that doesn't work. Now, moving forward to in terms of the information collection and processing infrastructure, we have challenges, and most of the time it's about awareness. We haven't seen a lot of push in terms of collecting aggressive data collection for purposes of commercialization. It perhaps ended a few years ago where there was a push by the UCC to curb the spam SMSs and unsolicited text messages that were being used for marketing, and that really burst a certain bubble. Now we're seeing a lot of leaks, but not exactly commercial oriented. There's people who are not doing their job, or people taking things for granted. And so there needs to be a strong emphasis on awareness and education. And then in terms of organizations, there must be regulation. Even on the side of the commercial banks, for example, Bank of Uganda is also able to lay down a couple of rules that financial institutions should be able to abide by. But also, it's a two-way street, because if consumers and end users are not able to, you know, stand up for their rights, then perhaps the balance will be tilted in the favor of the service providers or the companies that collect this information and want to commercialize it for whatever reason.
That's such a good point, because I've mentioned this before, and I see a lot of foreign companies, foreign founders coming to Uganda, and, you know, for whatever innovation they set up, they, if you ask them what their business model is, they'll often say, you know, they collect data and they want to sell it to big companies. And I wonder, you know, what laws are in place to protect the user from getting their data used by these bigger companies? Can you speak more to that?
I think today we have a gap in terms of the regulation, the local regulation, as we've said. Luckily, we are global village, and so we're able to depend or to leverage some of the tough regulation, for example, the GDPR in Europe. And so we're going to see a lot of people take care because they know the law will bite them or will catch up with them. And they're aware of the laws, especially those who are on the side of innovating and developing apps and collecting data from end users. But still, in terms of oversight, we do not have territorial oversight locally. So where the data is collected and the individuals on whom the data is collected do not really have that oversight being done for them at the government level. So it's a gap, and we need to engage, we need to push for the conversation and be able to articulate the kinds of risks and the kind of issues that we're facing. Africa is a high growth market. Everybody is looking to Africa. We are at risk. We are in the focus of data collection companies, and so we need to be able to take the right steps and do the right things.
We know the GDPR came in May 2018, and that's the data protection law for the European Union. And so my first experience of getting an email from an African organization about my data was from Ethiopian Airlines, just a few hours before GDPR was supposed to come into effect. I got an email saying that this is all of the information we have about you. This is how we're going to use your data. But if they did not mention some of the way that they, like, for instance, they have all of the information of where I traveled, where I've been, you know, how long I stay in places and all of those things, right? So I wanted to ask you more about, like, GDPR. What does GDPR do for people that are based in Africa and are using African organizations and have data within African, like, you know, companies?
All right. In my view, we benefit mostly from an African perspective. We benefit from GDPR, perhaps the same way you'd see a European or an American legislator mandating airbags or seatbelts. And because the cars are manufactured for the whole world, manufacturers are forced to put in airbags for everybody else. We need to take it from a point of benefiting passively to having active push to legislate and push back, because it's a battle. You know, when you look at the scale and enormity of the data collection programs, it's amazing. Some of these organizations collect more information than what government security agencies are able to collect, because they have a commercial push and they're able to monetize that data continuously. So we need to have active legislation. We've seen the African Union putting into place certain accords and agreeing to put data protection and privacy at the forefront. We've seen SADC, we've seen the East Africa community having some agreement in terms of where to move towards data privacy laws. Now we need to be able to put organizations around the table, the big, you'd call them the big five or the big 10, so that we're able to have people like Facebook and Google and Apple and whoever else is interacting with the billions of African internet users on a daily basis. We need to be able to put them around the table and shape an agenda that protects and makes it safe for African consumers to use their services and to be able to enjoy the data privacy and data protection that they expect.
What do you think is the biggest risk to us right now in terms of data privacy?
I look at it from more of a crime perspective, where people with malicious intent or criminals are able to leverage the laxity and the loopholes in data privacy to commit actual crime. We've seen cases where people are able to collude with staff in banks to to understand who has which balances and be able to, you know, kidnap them or even hold them at ransom. You might have certain information on your phone or pictures or whatever it is, and that's used by criminals too, or people with malicious intent. I don't want to say criminals because criminal sounds hardcore, but it gives an opportunity for somebody to blackmail you or to extort money from you. So you have many low-level crimes being perpetrated because somebody has information that perhaps they shouldn't have had access to. Mm. So given the exploding population of young people with tech skills but without jobs and without access to economic empowerment, we're going to see a lot of that kind of crime being perpetrated, and there must be some sort of response, some sort of structured approach towards making that harder and harder and giving people real alternatives.
That's a really great point, because that really brings down, it's not about like the technology, it's about fundamental rights of having, you know, making sure that your data is protected and that, you know, your right to privacy is also protected. And it's so maybe our last question for you is, who does the onus currently lie on in terms of data protection, in your opinion?
Need to do perhaps more awareness. We need to keep preaching the gospel, because every day the environment changes. People are interacting with apps and systems in more and more sophisticated ways. Information is collected with or without your knowledge. The commercialization of personal information is going up. And so consumers need to be aware, first of all, so that they make the right choices. We need to be able to put pressure on our governments and our legislators to think about information as a priority, information security as a priority.
All right. Thanks so much, Bernard, for joining us and for all your wisdom.
We've been actively following the network as a fellow at Mozilla. We're fellows working on their core principles that individual security and privacy are fundamental to online experience. So maybe, Lynette, can you introduce yourself, tell us what you do briefly, and then we can get started.
Yes. Hi, everyone. My name is Lynette Kwamboka, and I am the founder and CEO of Data Science Limited, a data analytics and research company based in Nairobi, Kenya. And I have been a Mozilla Fellow in the Tech Policy Fellowship.
Great. So our first question is, what does the current landscape of data privacy look like in our current context? Right now we're recording from Uganda, of course, Burhan's from Ethiopia, you're based in Kenya. What does that general context of data privacy look like?
It's pretty much non-existent in a way that I would say a lot of the main stakeholders, that's the citizen, the regular citizen, is really not as informed about the need for data protection or protecting of their data. And as a result, we have organizations and governments that are really not investing as much in ensuring that they ensure the highest levels of privacy. But also you have people or citizens in the in most African countries, I would say, who, while they are aware about the need for their data to be protected, they really feel very helpless and might not care as much.
One thing that has been really fascinating is how we think about like elections in the continent that we're in, and like I think Kenya is a really a prime example of how data can be misused for elections. So can you tell us a bit more about how, you know, the last election, the one that happened in 2013 and the last one that happened like last year, were different in terms of how data was used differently? And then also Kenya was blessed with Cambridge Analytica and were the guinea pigs for that. So can you tell us how that was different and what it meant as Kenya?
In 2013, the election was really not as digital as it was in 2017. But some of the things that we saw in 2013, for example, the parties were required to have a membership of at least 1 million people. And we had parties that went to Safaricom M-Pesa agents. The parties actually went to the agents and bought the information from them without the consent of people. So there was a list that was published by the commissioner in charge of registration of political parties. And when people were checking, they would find their names in various lists and you know, a lot of them said, I don't remember registering as a member of this party, and no one ever asked me to have my information here. And then, so that's how a lot of people found out that their information was actually being accessed unethically or without their permission. Last year, we had a very digital election, starting from the digital registration of voters to the verification part. And some parts of that are result transmission. The voting, of course, was manual, where you have to sign on a but then the transmission after the counting was done electronically. And one of the things that actually came out is, as well, the agents that were representing the IEBC, that's the commission that is responsible for the elections in Kenya, mm-hmm. Were actually selling the voter register to politicians. So, for instance, I received the text that was very specific to me, you know, with all my three names, my ID number, the place I'm going to vote. And this was a politician saying, hey, I'm vying in this ward, can you please vote for me? And I found that really intrusive. And I must say that I don't think I'm the only person that received that. I saw a lot of people, social media as well, talking about that. So it was quite intrusive when you think about it, someone having that level of information. And when we think about places like India, where, you know, with Aadhaar, there's a lot of biometric information was stolen. This is biometric information that was being collected in the country, and it was loosely given to a few individuals. I just don't think that we had enough people who had the mechanisms to do more with it. Just exposes citizens to a level of insecurity when it comes to their data that is quite dangerous. When you're thinking about for instance, the voter verification that was done online by the commission. So all you needed to do is go and enter your ID number and you get all the information about you. So wow. If I have your ID number, I just go and put that in. It tells me all your biodata, you know, where you were born, your date of birth, where you're supposed to vote, your gender, everything that can be put together to actually create another you, identity theft. So this is not even a hack. This was, you know, information that has been openly put out in a process that is legislated. That is the process of verifying that you're actually registered.
So what I'm trying to understand is it because they don't know or is it because they don't care?
In our case, I see that the trouble is people come into a lot of these solutions as an afterthought. So they end up spending very little time in doing the right architectural design thinking around how should this kind of an application look like. So I think the problem is that the institutions that are involved do not spend enough time, which is surprising because, for instance, in cases of exam results, these are things that happen every year. But then the result looks like it's something that was thought about 2 days ago.
Precisely.
So we need to really start spending more time in coming up with these systems.
Yeah, there was a really funny tweet that I read that designers should create an episode of Black Mirror whenever they make a product so that you can get the worst case scenario and then you work backwards from how to stop that from happening. And I thought that was really excellent. Like, if you can imagine all the worst case scenarios, then you wouldn't design tools that are so easy to hack or get information from. But I wanted to take us back to talking about Black Mirror, take us back to what you were mentioning about the impact of the now defunct Cambridge Analytica and Facebook on democracy in Kenya.
So in the case of Cambridge Analytica, I was saying I have two views to it. One is there was a lot of information that was used for psychometric. And honestly, the way I look at it, it's all science. It's all things that are already happening. You know, the twitching you get when you've not been on Facebook for very long. I had the pleasure of listening to Obama's chief scientist back in 2013 in a lecture he gave at Carnegie Mellon University, where I was at the time. And some of the formula that he actually explained that they used when, you know, a lot of the world was saying Obama used a lot of data for his campaigns is pretty much what I think Cambridge Analytica used. So let's fast start. I like to say that the biggest lie told on the internet is, yes, I have read and understood the terms and conditions of this service. We all just click and keep it moving. You know, I don't have time to read a 40-page legalese document. Cambridge Analytica, honestly, to some levels, did not do anything we'd give them permission to do. When you are accepting to Facebook's terms and conditions, part of that is you are allowing third-party applications to have access to your information. When I was mentioning the non-existent ecosystem of people who are aware about data protection and privacy in African countries, I think pretty much when that happened, when Cambridge Analytica happened, and we had a lot of people, especially celebrities, you know, the rich people saying, oh, I'm going to stop using Facebook, I'm deleting my Facebook. There's someone who sent out a really nice tweet and said, you know, to some people, Facebook is the internet. And there are countries where Facebook is the internet. You know, when they talk about the internet, then they talk about Facebook. But for instance, the people whose businesses are 100% run on Facebook. So when you look at people like those, the fact that a third-party company like Cambridge Analytica had access to their views and then used that to send them a post is really an issue when you think about it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's very interesting, right? So what makes Cambridge Analytica, like, it's, you've really contextualized it really well, and, you know, you've given us a very different perspective of advertisers do this and it's a very similar thing. It's just that they tried to change a democracy.
Unfortunately, out of time. Thank you so much.
It's really nice to be connected, and I hope we stay in touch and I look forward to the website.
So one other thing that we should also really think about when, you know, when we're talking about Cambridge Analytica and Facebook is also that, you know, it's not just about using people's information or, like, you know, finding out what cornflakes they eat or, like, how they'll be voting. There's a difference between what cornflakes you eat and, like, who you're voting for specifically. But then, you know, that data and that information has also been used to fan some of the ethnic tension in Kenya. So we've seen a lot of, like, what do you call them? Videos, for instance, that were posted on Facebook that, you know, we know the context that, you know, that that happened in 27 and 28 during the Kenyan election a few years ago. And then in the last one, there was also really high tension. And, you know, this information and this people's data have been used to fan that kind of hatred and that kind of ethnic tension in the country. So it becomes really questionable when it's very questionable when you're using people's data without their consent to convince them to vote in a certain way. But then when you're also using that data to, you know, figure out what ethnic groups people are and then send messages that are catered in that way is also quite unethical and is really dangerous. And I think it's important to note that when we're having this conversation.
Yeah, that just makes you think of an evil genius who can make anyone do anything depending on what kind of content they show them.
Mm-hmm.
And right, and who is more susceptible to taking action based on what they see. So yeah, it's a lot of power that can be concentrated in the hands of a few people depending on how it's used. So this has been such an interesting conversation, and I really want to thank Bernard and Lynette for coming by and sharing their wisdom and different perspectives. And yeah, I'd love to know from the rest of you what you think is going on. I think we do have an onus to put more pressure on our governments to make sure that these bills are passed in a way that works for the people.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes there's a thin line between censorship and privacy. So we really need to be having more of these conversations and thinking more deeply about how we protect ourselves online, how we protect our data, and how valuable that is to us. So I'm really happy to have had this conversation. I really want to carry it further. But for now, thanks to our guests. Thanks to Burhan for joining me in this conversation. And thank you to you for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, visit our website. It's termsandconditions.africa. You can also reach us on Twitter or Facebook. All right, get in touch with us, and thanks so much. Bye.